The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to an Extra Tech Weekly, which we're recording after last night's news that Steve Jobs is to resign from Apple as chief executive.
It always happens. Thank you. It always helps, and I appreciate it very much.
Though last night's news should probably have been expected after Jobs' recurrent health problems and leave of absence since January, the announcement was still a shock after, as we heard there, he appeared in June to launch iCloud. Probably no other business leader is as talismanic for their company as Steve was for Apple, and it's with that in people's minds that thoughts also turn to what happens next for the company that just 2 weeks ago edged past oil group Exxon to become the world's most valuable company by market capitalisation. So let's discuss some of that now with Charles Arthur, our technology editor, and Dan Crowe. He's chief technology officer at Songkick, but also spent 4 years at Apple until 2000. So, as we just said, this was a shock, but we probably should have seen it all coming, shouldn't we, Charles?
Well, I guess that we know it was coming because Steve Jobs had been looking increasingly ill, and it was quite clear that there's some sort of problem relating to the cancer that he was diagnosed with in 2003 and liver transplant that he had in 2009. So, in that sense, no, it's not a shock. I think, actually, it's a fantastically clever piece of PR management, you know, rather than the shock of his death, we have him leaving very gradually, sort of fading away from the spotlight.
So actually it's had the effect of prepping shareholders. There isn't really much of a shock here, is there? Because they've had a very long time to get used to the fact that there has to be a succession. There is no sudden departure.
In a way, it's being handled rather like an Apple product launch. You know, there's the big news that Jobs is taking medical leave in January for an open period. That Tim Cook is once again going to step up and effectively take over the day-to-day operations, and then you have the situation where you're told that okay, now he's actually gone for good, and you have a gradual phasing in. So, you know, in that way, you have the sort of the big noise, and then everything else happens, and it's again, you know, Apple's just very good at this sort of PR.
We're always told that there's the impression that Steve is so much a part of Apple that there's massive concern that Apple might not be able to survive without him. But listening to Steve Wozniak talking about him, he said that actually the thinking is the cleverness in Apple is about the group of people that Steve was able to bring together that all had a similar kind of thinking about those products. How true is it, this perception that Steve is Apple?
I tend to think it's pretty true, actually. The interesting thing about working with Steve is that he's such a charismatic person and so driven to build extraordinary products that it really is the case, I think, that Apple is a company founded very much in his image. And it was very interesting being there at the time. You know, when I joined Apple, it was before Steve came back. And Apple was a company that in all sorts of ways was in terrible trouble. And then Steve came back and really within about 18 months completely transformed that company both internally and externally. And it really was the force of his personality that did that. I don't think anyone else would have been capable of saving Apple and turning it from a company that was on the outs to what it is now, the greatest technology company in the world, perhaps. And so I think that, you know, I wonder how Apple is going to survive as Steve transitions out.
There's a lot of hyperbole around Apple. I mean, for a company that does relatively little outreach to the press, does very few interviews, they have a phenomenal amount of coverage and media interest. They have had a remarkable last few years. I mean, it's very easy to get caught up in the hyperbole and say that they've redefined personal computing, they redefined mobile phones, they redefined music players. How much of that is testament to Steve's genius in whipping up excitement about Apple products, and how much of that is it genuinely significant and revolutionary for the technology sector?
Steve is particularly good at two things. One, as you said, I think he is the greatest marketer that there is in our time. I think he just has a phenomenal ability to communicate with the public. But I think the other side, and I think it's really important to remember this, is that he's also probably, in my estimation, the greatest product, intuitive product person that there is in the technology industry. His ability to understand what it is about a product that people will, you know, react to, will love, will get excited about, and to create really compelling products that genuinely change the world, is unparalleled. I mean, his track record is just extraordinary. And so I think that it's a combination of the two of those things. It's not just marketing, but it's also the ability to create those products, which I think is really most impressive.
And are these portraits of Steve as a tyrant quite fair? He's had a reputation for being quite bullying and dominating in his pursuit of relentless perfection.
Well, certainly in my personal experience, I think they pretty much are. I mean, he is a perfectionist. He is a micromanager. When he cares about something, he absolutely will accept no compromise in creating that vision. And so, you know, he's a hard taskmaster, and he's a difficult person to work for. But the flip side of that is that you end up creating something extraordinary. I mean, certainly I and my team, I think, ended up building software that we just did not believe we were capable of building something that elegant and, you know, refined. And so to be part of that is an extraordinary moment. And certainly for me was sort of career defining. I don't know. I personally want to go back and work with Steve again. He's a very difficult person, but he demands of you something that really kind of brings out the best in you. And that's an amazing experience.
Well, before we talk more about Apple's future, let's look back at how influential Steve Jobs has been to Apple in the past with co-founder Steve Wozniak. Here he is explaining what happened when Steve Jobs revealed the advertisement for the original Mac computer to him back in 1984.
Steve called me over one time and he said, "You've got to see this ad." He sat me down in front of a U-Matic tape machine and played the 1984 ad one time. And I was stunned because I was a bit naive. I thought it was just incredible science fiction. The sounds going along, the woman running, she's kind of fighting some big authority figure. It was very rebellious in a sense. And I said, "Wow, we're going to show this on the Super Bowl? This is the best ad I'd ever seen." And Steve said, "Well, the board sort of turned it down because it cost too much. It cost like $800,000. And I didn't realize the board turned it down because they were shaky about coming out, you know, against Big Blue, against the big companies that were so organized and structured. I didn't realize that. I thought it was the money. So I thought about it, you know. And Steve and I were fairly wealthy by then. I said, "Well, I'll pay half of it if you will. If you'll pay the other half, you know, this thing should be shown. I mean, this is us." You know, it was such a good demonstration of how we were out there trying to challenge the norm.
I think he
hired the right people, a lot of them from Hewlett-Packard, a lot from Digital Equipment, some very bright academicians that thought about computers working for humans. I think they really created the world that is today Macintosh within Apple. But they didn't like Steve's personality because Steve would have a vision and they would fight it. They would have a different vision of their own. And they just got tired of Steve calling them idiots and this and that.
But after that episode, Steve Jobs left Apple in 1985 and spent the next 12 years at Next Computer. Charles, can you tell us a bit about this stage of his career?
Okay, his time at Next was interesting because he tried to start up another hardware company. And also with some of the money that he had from his Apple stock, he also bought a little unregarded film animation company called Pixar from George Lucas. It was a sort of a dowry from George Lucas getting divorced. And one of the interesting things he discovered at Next, where he was trying to design computers that were fantastic and that would do, you know, life-defining things, was that it was really hard to make any impact on the PC market. And really, I think the lesson that he learned at Next was that a company that's making hardware has to be incredibly disciplined. And the lesson that he learned at Pixar was that you have to have creative people and you have to let them really be able to be creative and not to get in the way of their creativity. I mean, Pixar is worth noting is now a company which is unparalleled in the film industry because it's made a profit on every film that it's released. And it's you know, by those sorts of measures, it's the most successful film studio in Hollywood, or was until it was bought by Disney. And with Next, which actually then got bought by Apple, it was one of the engineers at Next got in touch with Apple when they realized the problems that Apple was having in coming up with a next generation operating system in the mid-90s. It turned out to be a perfect fit. And Steve Jobs came back to Apple, worked his way through to the board and got the then chief executive, Jill Amelio, pushed out. And he set about just reorganizing Apple around the principles that he had discovered in a rather painful way at Next, which is you have to be really efficient and you have to be really focused on great products that people want.
So Apple bought Next in 96. And so Steve joined in a kind of consultant capacity and then had joined the board in 97, I think. When he returned, the iMac, the iPod, the iPhone, iTunes, and the effects that all of those products have had on respective industries, how influential was Steve in each of those devices?
Well, the iMac was a sort of an idea that had germinated in Jonathan Ive's mind even before Jobs had come back. He was you know, working on designs with it, and Steve Jobs recognized Jonathan Ive as a great design mind. He sort of picked them out from all the many people within Apple who were then there, because, you know, there was really a purge went on, in effect. He just cut a sway through lots of projects that he said weren't performing, weren't core, weren't important. You know, he said that at one point after he came back, Apple was just 90 days from the bankruptcy court. And when you consider that it's gone from that in his time to being the most valuable company on the planet, you can see, you know, what sort of impact he had. But the vision that he brought was, well, we have to have products that people want. And the thing that Apple does, and if you look back through what its functions have been and the way that it's sort of oriented itself, it always tries to cut out the middleman. And you know, the way that you see the fact that Apple drew back from selling its products through stores, was doing it on the web, and then opened its own chain of retail store when the iPod was only just launched. Everyone said that the retail stores would fail, but actually they worked fantastically in getting the product into people's hands. Same with the iPhone. Apple tries to cut out you know, as many of the people in the middle. So it's, as much as anything, it's a sort of business model, it's a way of thinking. But the impact has been huge, I think, because you see other companies try to emulate Apple, but I think that so many of them fail. And the reason why they fail is they don't consider the things that are important, like cutting out the middleman and making products that people really, really want to have.
Dan, are there any of those products, or is there anything at Apple that doesn't have the Steve Jobs touch in it, that doesn't have that Steve Jobs way of working?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the interesting thing with Steve is he manages to influence the company internally, directly and indirectly. So some projects he really cares about. So on the QuickTime player, you know, we spent a lot of time with Steve, and he was, you know, managing every last pixel of the interface and improving every last little bit of behavior. But a lot of projects don't have him. You know, obviously one person can't have that level of involvement in every product that Apple does. But even where he's not personally directly involved, his philosophy is so well understood within the company that his kind of influence does pervade, I think, really everything that Apple does.
That's very interesting. I mean, is that influence and that kind of that understanding of what Steve expected and how Steve worked, is that enough to drive Apple forward, to keep it, to make sure that it maintains the same levels and standards and achieves the same success?
Well, I'm sure in the short term, I mean, in the next few years, I'm sure it will be. So it's not that I would expect Apple to suddenly stop being what it is. But I think over the sort of the medium and the long term, it's hard to see how that influence can remain at the level that it does now, because Steve is such a personality, and his, you know, personal influence is an incredibly powerful tool that's used within the company to maintain the standards. And although, you know, he absolutely has surrounded himself with some incredibly smart, incredibly good people from Tim Cook on down, I think inevitably some of that influence and culture will fade over time.
Looking forward then, talking of new personalities, Tim Cook is the new chief executive. Charles, what do we know about him?
He's a very reserved sort of person. To my knowledge, he's never done any of the keynotes. I haven't seen him talking at any of them. It tends to be Phil Schiller, who's the marketing manager, who's sort of more outgoing, sort of friendly bear of a guy who does those and is very good at them. And I suspect actually that it'll be Schiller who does it. Tim Cook is he's a very operations driven guy. He came from IBM and then Compaq, and his focus is really all about work, all about getting the tiny details right, and especially when it comes to supply chains. I mean, the reason why Jobs brought him in was because he wanted someone who would drive Apple towards efficiency, the efficiency that he realized it had to have. And that's what Cook is really good at, is seeing about, you know, it's about things like capacitors and about circuit boards and about what's the best price with the best quality assurance you can get. All these sorts of things that just sound really trivial and boring, but actually that's the difference between sort of mediocrity and greatness when it comes to hardware. So he's someone who works all the time. You know, it's said that he's always got his head buried in a spreadsheet. And yet also has a fantastic grip on what is going on. So, you know, one former colleague described him as having a mind like a steel trap. So I think that he's, when you hear him on the earnings calls, he's quite evasive in a rather subtle and dry way. I don't think that he's going to have quite the same charisma as Steve Jobs had, but then very few people had. But I think it'll be interesting to see how effective he is at the negotiation with other companies, say content companies, who are always very protective of their content. And that's where Steve Jobs was fantastic as a negotiator, was that he could read what it was that people wanted out of negotiation, and he could offer it to them. I think it'll be interesting to see how effective Tim Cook is at that.
Dan, what's your impression of Tim Cook? I mean, does he have the same vision of products, the same kind of joy in a new product that Steve Jobs has? Or maybe does he not need that? Is he going to have a very different leadership style?
So I didn't know Tim personally. We overlapped for a short while at Apple, but I didn't get to know him. But certainly the impression I get from talking with, you know, colleagues who I still know at Apple is that Tim is very different from Steve. And that what we'll see is that Apple won't have a single person who replaces Steve, but will have a raft of executives. So, Phil Schiller is definitely one of them, who I think does have some of that kind of outgoing presentational skills and will perhaps replace that part of what Steve did. Tim is absolutely an operations guy. And one thing that's important to remember about Steve is that Steve was a real operations guy as well, particularly if you look at the early history of Apple, his first go round. He was absolutely critical in setting up the early deals that allowed Apple to build its hardware and become a successful company in the first place. So, you know, it's another aspect of Steve's personality that's getting replaced by a person. So it's almost like they're trying to sort of fragment Steve and replace him with multiple people, each of whom has, you know, does one aspect of what Steve did really well. I think that was a remarkable thing about Steve, was that he did several things just at, you know, world-class levels, and you rarely see that in one person who can operate at that level in so many different disparate areas.
Charles, if Steve isn't well enough to be CEO, is there really much point in him staying on as chair, or is this just a token role?
It's a token role. The chairman of Apple's board doesn't really do anything. I mean, when it comes to things like takeovers and so on, that's really all decided below the board level. The board has for years simply been a rubber stamp. If you look at the composition of the board, it's a fair number of outsiders. You've got people from Genentech. You've got used to have Eric Schmidt, and actually the board doesn't drive the company. The company drives the company, so the chairman's role is simply a titular one. And I think, as Dan says, that it really means he hasn't got the time. You know, he's really focusing on himself and I think his family now.
Okay, thank you very much, Charles, and apologies to listeners for the occasional share impression that Charles did thanks to his Skype line. And thanks very much to Dan Crowe as well from Songkick. There's more on Apple on our site, of course, at guardian.co.uk/technology. I'm Jemima Kish, and the programme was produced by Scott Corley. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.